Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. There's so much going on we're going to get into today. Fiona Hill, the former National Security Council Senior Director for Europe and Russia, and David Holmes, who works at the U.S. Embassy in Kiev, or what used to be pronounced as Kiev. I guess it's Kyiv now. Both testifying this morning. So far, we have heard them being questioned by the Democrats. And right now, the entire committee is in break because they had to go vote on some legislation on the floor of the House of Representatives. And then when they come back, it's going to be the Republicans' turn to ask them the questions. And I think that's going to get real interesting because Fiona Hill is basically saying, you Republicans, particularly Devin Nunes, you Republicans are promoting a conspiracy theory that literally came out of Russia, some kind of Russian disinformation campaign. And then David Holmes is saying that, yeah, he heard Trump ask Sondland at lunch. He overheard the phone call. Trump is tweeting, ah, you can't overhear a phone call. I've been doing it my whole life. Nobody can overhear it. And Connie Schultz, the reporter and wife of the Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown, she tweeted out saying, I was sitting in the back seat when you were talking to a certain person we both know, presumably Sherrod Brown, and I could hear every word you said. Your voice carries. And a bunch of other people, you know, I guess Anderson Cooper or somebody on CNN tried it live on the air and they succeeded in doing it. So that's going on. At the same time, Benjamin Netanyahu is just indicted for fraud and, you know, a couple of other basically corruption issues. And so that's going on. Israel, of course, failed to form a government, or the opposition character, a fellow, failed to form a government yesterday. And then we had the Democratic debates last night. And so what I'm going to do is pick up your calls, you know, now and on and off throughout the day, whenever there's a break, and when the interrogation is back on, when the Intelligence Committee, the Impeachment Committee is back live, we will go to that, as long as it's interesting. I mean, I'm guessing, once again, when it gets to the members' questions, that I'll probably be hopping in and doing summaries and offering commentary, in particular on top of some of the Republicans. But we'll see. We'll see where it goes. So these are some of the many things that are going on in the world today. Oh, my thoughts on last night's debate. I don't think anybody really hurt themselves last night. I think probably the person who helped themselves the most was Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar also. Both of them did good performances, although Amy seemed to be, I don't know if there was an air vent above her because her hair was, you know, fluttering there, or if she's got a little tremble, but it looked kind of strange. Maybe more hairspray next time around. But other than that, you know, and I my first thought was, you know, is this going to be kind of a Nixon moment? And then I thought, nah, this will just slide by and, you know, nobody's going to be, you know, obsessed on that. I thought that Cory Booker saying to Joe Biden, you're saying marijuana is a gateway drug, are you high? Was great. Joe Biden had a comeback all ready for it. You know, we're going to let all these people out of jail who are there for marijuana, but he wants to decriminalize but not legalize. I thought that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders both did excellent jobs last night. Pete Buttigieg did a good job. I don't think anybody did poorly. Joe Biden was having trouble, you know, grabbing words here and there from time to time. And, you know, we've seen him do that in every single one of the debates. And apparently that's something that, you know, he's just, hey, that's Joe. You know, I don't know if he's always been that way or if this is something new, but apparently it's not a big issue, at least among the TV commentariat. So we've had 2 days of impeachment hearings, and we had the Democratic debates last night. I'm curious your thoughts on, you know, where this is all going. It's increasingly looking to me like the Republicans have bought into this disinformation campaign suggesting that Ukraine was who hacked the DNC, not Russia. And Fiona Hill saying this is coming right out of the Russian intelligence services. Whether that is the case or whether it's coming out of the oligarchs in Russia, or some Russian oligarchs, or some Russian and Ukrainian oligarchs. Keep in mind, you know, one of them is building a factory in Kentucky right now to help Mitch McConnell get reelected. One of the reasons they're calling him Moscow Mitch. I'm still, you know, in my own mind, a little uncertain about which is the issue. I am seeing, frankly, if you want to get into conspiracy theories, I'm seeing a worldwide network, essentially, of billionaire oligarchs who are trying to make the world safe for oligarchy. And this is, in my opinion, not unique to Russia. I mean, it's certainly happened in Russia and is happening in Russia, but it's also happening in Brazil right now. It's how Jair Bolsonaro got in there. It's happening in Ecuador. I think the oligarchs are responsible for the overthrow there. It's that, you know, that you've got Viktor Orban in Hungary, his oligarchic buddies, his billionaire buddies have bought up all the media. It's happened in Poland where Duda, the same, you know, President Duda, the same thing. It's happened in the Philippines with Duterte. It's happening in Indonesia. And it's happening in the United States. We have an oligarch now as president. We have a billionaire, or at least somebody who claims to be a billionaire, as president. And he was put into place in part by American oligarchs like Robert Mercer and his daughter Rebecca, who, you know, funded so much of the Trump campaign, and Shelley Adelson and the Koch brothers, down to one brother now, I guess, who are politically active. It's just like it's oligarchy on parade. And so I'm less inclined to view Russia as a single source of all evil in the world. And, oh, and frankly, China is in on it with the oligarchs, too. Oh, and one other thing that happened, and I'll pick up your phone calls. Yesterday, Donald Trump went to a factory in Texas where they're manufacturing Apple products and met Tim Apple there, Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple that Trump referred to as Tim Apple recently. And Trump did a little press conference and said, when I got elected president, I said, you know, they're going to start making stuff here in America. And now, because of me, Apple is manufacturing these things right here in America. And Tim Cook is standing right next to him. This factory opened in like 2013, 2014, something like that. I mean, during Obama's presidency. And it's not even an Apple plant. It's a third-party company. It's a contractor. Apple, by and large, doesn't manufacture their own stuff, just like Nike doesn't make shoes. You know, they have it manufactured by other companies, and then they, you know, they're basically a brand marketing company and increasingly a data services company, as is happening, you know, all across the whole area. So anyhow, those are my thoughts. Let's pick up some of yours. Mark in Santa Rosa. Hey, Mark, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm a former nuclear weapons inspector with a top security clearance, DOD, DOE.
Okay.
I have a quick blow-by of what Trump has been doing. Do you remember when he got out of North Korea? The first words out of his mouth were, gee, my hotels would look great on their beaches.
That's right.
It shows you he is using sanctions and these tariffs to get hotels on beaches. He orchestrated the killing of the newspaper reporter, sending him to Turkey to pay off his loan with Saudi Arabia for his Twin Towers.
Oh, hang on a second there, Mark. Khashoggi was in Turkey to marry his girlfriend. And that's why he went into the embassy in Saudi Arabia, was he had to get a marriage license.
An authorization by his administration. He then paid off Turkey for allowing them to, for Saudi Arabia to kill him. by allowing them to get the 30 miles of where he brought the 50
of northern Syria
going to kill the Kurds.
Yeah.
That's how he paid off his Turkey loans. His Saudi Arabia loans were paid off also by that. Qatar.
Oh, wait a minute. So you're suggesting that Trump has borrowed money from both Turkey and Saudi Arabia, and by giving them, you know, thousands of square miles of northern Syria, they canceled his debt?
People, by giving him land, by all these dirty deeds that he's doing. This was all.
Do you have any evidence of that, Mark? Or is this your theory?
It's a theory based on facts of the actions that he's taken.
Oh, I get that his actions, in my mind, really indicate that there's some hidden agenda here. I just assumed that it was that, you know, future business deals. But having them cancel debt, not impossible. Certainly not impossible. You know, this guy, our grifter in chief, right? The grifter in chief is just, you know, he's going to do what grifters do. He's going to grift.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Also today, the testimony of Fiona Hill, the former NSC Senior Director for Europe and Russia, and David Holmes from the U.S. Embassy in Kiev. Well, Congress, the impeachment committee just reconvened, and Devin Nunes is trying to do his little conspiracy theory thing with Fiona Hill. He just kicked it off to the counsel, Mr. Castor. So here's the lawyer for the Republicans.
Thank you. You're a late entrant into this situation, and things sure did escalate quickly. We spoke with you last Friday night about what we thought was going to be a 30-second vignette, about a two-minute phone call, and turns out you know, with your 40-minute opener today, you have a lot of information to share. So we appreciate you being here, Dr. Hill. Your last day at the National Security Council was July 19th. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes.
So you weren't involved with the July 25th call, and you weren't involved with any of the relevant activities related to the pause and the aid.
I was not. That's correct.
And as of July 19th, did you believe that a call was going to be scheduled for the 25th?
I personally did not believe that it was going to be scheduled that date, no.
And what was the thinking at the NSC as of July 19th about such a call?
Well, I've learned from other depositions, to be clear here, that perhaps there was some awareness that there might be a call. Ambassador Sondland, if you may recall, showed an exchange with the person who was taking over from my position, Tim Morrison, in which he indicated that there would be a call coming up. I was not aware of that.
Okay. Were you in favor?
So there were differences, let's just say, obviously, in understanding about that call.
And were you in favor of such a call as of the 19th?
Actually, I was not, and I did say something about that in the opening part of the sessions today.
Okay. And how about Ambassador Bolton, to your knowledge?
Well, I know that Ambassador Sondland said in that email that Bolton was in agreement. To my knowledge, Bolton was not in agreement at that particular juncture,
and
to my knowledge.
Do you know what his opposition was?
It was based on the fact that he didn't feel the call had been properly prepared, and as I said earlier, that we wanted to make sure that there was going to be a fulsome bilateral U.S.-Ukraine agenda that was discussed, which is usual with these calls.
And were you surprised that a call ultimately was scheduled?
I was when I learned about it, that's right.
And did you have any communications with anyone back at your old staff about how that came to be?
I did not, no.
Okay. You did learn about the pause in the security assistance aid.
I learned about that on July 18th, so the day before I left, that's
okay.
Correct.
And there were several meetings about this, I believe you testified to?
I said that I knew there was going to be a meeting in that time frame, and there was one put onto the schedule for the following week. But of course, I had
this
left.
This is, the Republican lawyer, Mr. Castor, is trying to dig into this. But this is fascinating. Over on the New York Times, Katie Edmondson, a reporter there, is noting during the break, Jim Jordan criticized Holmes' testimony for taking too long, considering that he only overheard a two-minute call. Presumably, that would be on on Fox News. I'm not sure where else. And then Trump retweeted that. And now we see this lawyer, Castor, is working Jim Jordan's comment and Trump's retweet into his opening questions. And then Katie Rogers notes Stephanie Grisham, the White House press secretary, just released a statement, quote, as has been the case throughout the Democrats' impeachment sham, today's witnesses rely heavily on their own presumptions, assumptions, and opinions. These two witnesses, just like the rest, have no personal or direct knowledge regarding why U.S. aid was temporarily withheld. End of quote. Well, why don't you just tell us then, Stephanie Grisham, or Donald Trump, tell us why you withheld that aid. Anyhow, back to the hearing.
Ambassador Volker, Ambassador Sondland, they had become a little bit more involved with Ukraine policy.
Well, Ambassador Volker was always involved in Ukraine policy, at least since the beginning of his appointment as the special envoy for negotiations towards the war between Ukraine and Russia in Donbass.
What can you tell us about Ambassador Volker?
Ambassador Volker is an extraordinarily accomplished diplomat. I've worked with him in many capacities previously. You know his bio. He's been the ambassador to NATO.
Volker testified on Tuesday and is one of the three amigos.
At the State Department. And actually, I know him personally. So, you know, in the truth that we're trying to get at it, who knows who and who's met. I know Ambassador Volker really well on a personal level as well.
Okay. And you said he's a man of integrity.
That's correct.
And always acted in the best interest of the United States?
Absolutely, yes.
When did you first learn of Ambassador Sondland's involvement?
Well, it came in different ways. Ambassador Sondland, as the ambassador to the EU, had some perfectly logical involvement in the Ukraine portfolio. We worked very closely with the European Union on matters related to Ukraine. The Ukrainian dialogue with Russia was in a format known as the Minsk process, which was led by the French and the Germans. And Ambassador Volker was trying to find out ways in which he could work closely with the French and Germans to move along on the resolution of the conflict between Ukraine and Russia. And obviously the European Union, as the umbrella organization for Europe in terms of funding and assistance, was heavily active in offering financial assistance to the Ukrainian government as well as humanitarian assistance in the conflict. So it was perfectly logical that Ambassador Sondland would play some kind of role as our ambassador to the European Union.
Did you have any concerns when he presented himself to you as somebody with a major role?
I did at the time in which he presented it to me. This was after Ambassador Yovanovitch had been pushed out of her position. And it was at that juncture that Ambassador Sondland's role seemed to grow larger.
And did you express any concerns to him directly?
I did express concerns.
Katie Edmondson over at the New York Times is noting that in her closed-door testimony, Fiona Hill made it clear that she thought Sondland was out of his depth. Sondland apparently repeatedly gave out her personal cell phone number to officials from other countries who wanted a meeting with Bolton, her boss. It's pretty outside of protocol.
And he said that he was in charge of Ukraine. And I said, well, who put you in charge, Ambassador Sondland? And he said, the president.
Did that surprise you when he told you that?
It did surprise me. We'd had no directive. We hadn't been told this. Ambassador Bolton had never indicated in any way that he thought that Ambassador Sondland was playing a leading role in Ukraine.
Right. I believe you used the term a large remit, that he characterized he had been given a large remit from the president.
I can't remember what I said, remit, but it was portfolio. He was constantly, you know, these are all synonyms. He was talking to us about the fact that he'd been given a very broad portfolio by the president. He said his job was to go out and make deals in Europe. And as you know yourself, I listened to his testimony yesterday very carefully as well. He said that anything that had to do with the EU itself and the European Union member states was within his portfolio.
Right. We asked Ambassador Sondland about that at his deposition, and he conceded that he may have been spinning a little bit when he said that the president specifically gave him that role, and he indicated that his authority was coming at least a little bit from the Secretary of State. At any point in time, was that related to you?
At different points, he mentioned talking directly to the Chief of Staff Mulvaney, and he also talked about Secretary Pompeo. But he was very, in fact, there were other people in the room in the meeting in which he asserted this to me.
I think one of the big questions right now is whether Pompeo is actively involved in this thing that Bolton called a drug deal. It's fairly clear that Mick Mulvaney was. He's the one who put the hold on the military assistance. that Donald Trump was. He's the one who ordered it and pushed these people into it. But, you know, the question of Pompeo's role, because Pompeo really, really wants to be the Republican senator from Kansas, and they're trying to recruit him in Kansas. And I think he's starting to feel a little burned here. Anyhow, back to Dr. Hill.
In which her reputation had been maligned repeatedly on television and in all kinds of exchanges. I felt that that was completely unnecessary. If the president wanted to remove an ambassador, which he did quite frequently, there was a number of ambassadors removed who were not political but career officials. That was done, but without these kinds of interventions. I wondered what that message was being sent. So there was that. And then on the second front, it was very clear at this point that there was, let's just say, a different channel in operation in relations to Ukraine, one that was domestic and political in nature, and that was very different from the channel or the loop, however you like it, that I and my colleagues were in, where we were focused on bilateral relations and U.S. foreign policy.
I think the main thing that the caster, the lawyer for the Republicans, is trying to do right now with Fiona Hill is he's trying to impeach Sondland.
Did you have any communications with officials at the State Department about your concerns?
I did.
And who did you relate those concerns to?
I related those concerns directly to my counterpart, who was acting Assistant Secretary Phil Rico, who I know you've spoken to. I also spoke
to... See, if they can marginalize Sondland, then the impact of his testimony becomes less.
I covered a broad portfolio myself, and we often would talk about individual items. And I had private discussions with Deputy Secretary Sullivan, and he, of course, has appeared before committees here in the course of his nomination to be ambassador to Russia and has spoken about that himself.
Okay. And you advocated to all those officials about your concerns about the information being spread about Ambassador Yovanovitch?
I did, that's correct.
She's speaking of the Republican smear campaign against the ambassador that we heard from on, Monday.
Arming the Ukrainians with the javelins.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We're listening to Republican Attorney Castor questioning Dr. Fiona Hill.
Institution in that juncture. Because I was very worried at that particular point in time that the Ukrainian military was not in a fit state to really take on board sophisticated weapons, be they defensive or offensive weapons. And I worried that there was not a long-term sustainable plan given the overwhelming force that the Russians could apply against the Ukrainians. However, when I came into government in 2017 and started to interact with all of my colleagues in the Pentagon, and you had Laura Cooper here yesterday, I realized, in fact, that there'd been an awful lot of work done on this and that there was a clear and consistent plan for the sustainability long term of the Ukrainian military. So I changed my mind.
Okay. And you're in fact, one of the, I believe, the only witness that we've spoken to that has been able to articulate the opposition to providing the javelins. And as we understand it, during the Obama administration, the interagency consensus was, in fact, to provide the javelins, but they were not provided. Were you aware of the decision back then?
I was, and I think it was very much made on a political basis about concerns that this would provoke the Russians, depending on how this was presented. And we were very mindful of that also when there were the discussions internally about the lethal defensive weapons inside of the administration.
And Mr. Holmes, you're on the ground in Kyiv, and the javelins have now been authorized, provided. What's the view from the field, the U.S. Embassy, as to the effectiveness of the javelins?
They're an important strategic deterrent. They're not actively employed in combat operations right now, but the mere idea that were the Russians to advance substantially using certain kinds of armor, that the Ukrainians would have this capability, deters them from doing so. It also thereby sends a very important symbolic message to the Ukrainian military that they have access to this high-end technology and that we trust them to do it. I would only add also that they've offered to buy some using their own funds. The initial tranche was provided through a program to do that, but they've now offered to spend their own money to buy more. So I think they think they're important.
And Ambassador Taylor has testified, Mr. Kent has testified that this is, in fact, the consensus of the interagency providing the javelins. Is it the in your experience working with Ambassador Taylor, was he also very very much an advocate for this?
Yes.
Um,
Mr. Holmes, I want to go back to name some Americans. Now I want to talk a little bit about Ukrainians, Ukrainian government officials.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with Sergei Leshchenko?
Yes.
Have you met with him?
I have.
Okay. He was a journalist, then he was in the parliament. Is he currently in the parliament?
Journalist again.
Journalist again. Are you aware that when he was in the parliament, that he had provided information to a Fusion GPS operative named Nelly Orr?
I'm not aware of Nelly Orr. I'm not aware of who he provided information to. I'm aware that as a journalist, he's provided information.
Well, he was in the parliament at the time. This is in the 2016 campaign. He provided widely known as the Black Ledger. Have you ever heard of the Black Ledger?
I have.
And the Black Ledger, is that seen as credible information?
Yes.
The Black Ledger is credible?
Yes.
Bob Mueller did not find it credible. Do you dispute what Bob Mueller's findings were? They didn't use it in the prosecution or in the report.
I'm not aware that Bob Mueller did not find it credible. I think it was evidence in other criminal proceedings. Its credibility was not questioned in those proceedings, but I'm not an expert on that.
So the motivation for Leshchenko, as was reported to, was to go after a Trump campaign official and undermine Trump's candidacy. Are you aware of that?
If you mean by the release of the Black Ledger, I think Leshchenko's motivation.
Devin Nunes is trying to assert that the Black Ledger, this was the book that had all of had all these bribes that Poroshenko was paying to people, including to Paul Manafort, that was used to prosecute Paul Manafort for tax fraud, that was actually a fraud. And it's really interesting because David Holmes is saying, no, sorry, it was real. This is Nunes interrogating Holmes.
You heard Dr. Hill's testimony, but the Steele dossier that contained initially that initial information that was fed in the FBI, were you aware that the Democrats had paid for that information?
That was given to the FBI by John McCain, by the way.
I'm not accusing of involvement. I'm just asking if you, not even if you knew at the time, but you now know today that the Democrats had paid for that information.
So I do want to be clear that all that happened before I arrived in Ukraine, so I don't have any firsthand.
Not accusing any involvement of you with the Steele dossier.
Understood. But I do want to be clear about that. And then in addition, I have read about those issues, but I'm not an expert on them.
But you're not disputing that the Democrats and the Clinton campaign were the source of funds that funded the Steele dossier?
I wouldn't be in a position to dispute that, sir.
Actually, it was originally paid for by the Republicans. I think it was Marco Rubio's campaign.
To run operatives in foreign countries to dig up dirt on their opponents?
No.
Dr. Hill, do you think it's appropriate for political parties to pay operatives to dig up dirt on their opponents?
I do not.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey guys, remember the days when you were always ready to go? Now you can increase your performance and get that extra confidence in bed. Listen up, BlueChew.com, that's blue like the color blue. BlueChew brings you the first chewable with the same FDA-approved active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis. So you know they work. You can take them anytime, day or night, even on a full stomach. And since they're chewable, they work up to twice as fast as a pill, so you can be ready whenever an opportunity arises. If you could benefit from extra function and more confidence where it counts, Blue Chew is the fast and easy way to enhance your performance. Blue Chew is prescribed online and ships straight to your door in a discreet package, so no in-person doctor's visit, no waiting in the pharmacy, and best of all, no more awkwardness. They're made in the USA, and since Blue Chew prepares and ships direct, they're cheaper than a pharmacy. Right now, we've got a special deal for our listeners. Visit BlueChew.com and get your first shipment free when you use our special promo code TOM. Just pay $5 in shipping. Again, that's BlueChew.com, promo code THOM, Tom, to try it for free. Blue Chew, the better, cheaper, faster choice. And we thank them for sponsoring the podcast.
Mr. Castor.
Turn to the President Zelensky's inauguration. Ambassador Volker testified that he was
Very pleased with the size of the delegation, although the vice president was unable to make the trip.
This is Castor, the lawyer for the Republicans.
Ambassador Volker, Ambassador Sondland. And I understand, Dr. Hill, you were involved with some of the logistics and putting the delegation together. What can you tell us about the vice president's role in attending or not attending?
Well, I know that you've had the testimony of Jennifer Williams from the vice president's office, and I defer to her as being much closer to the decision-making about the vice president's attendance. I will say that I and many others hoped that the vice president would be able to attend. Mm-hmm. What I know from my perspective, mm-hmm. because I was not involved intimately in discussions with the vice president or his immediate staff, was that there were some questions about the schedule. As you all know, the president and vice president can not be out of the country at the same time. And there were some questions about presidential travel in the same time frame. There was quite a bit of back and forth as to whether it would be really feasible for the vice president in that time frame to go. So that was what I was aware of. I wasn't aware to the extent of the discussions that obviously Ms. Williams was involved in.
Right. The president was traveling in Japan, and then he was headed to Europe for the D-Day anniversary. The vice president's office, according to Ms. Williams, provided 4 days, the end of May, the 29th, 30th, 31st, June 1st. And as it turned out, the Ukrainians decided, I believe it was on May 16th, to schedule the inauguration for.
I think he's trying to go
later.
To a, there's no here
by this point in time,
defense, but I'm not sure.
The vice president had been rerouted for a trip to Canada about the USMCA. And
in other words, he's trying to establish that it was a perfectly reasonable thing that both the president and the vice president didn't go to Ukraine for the inauguration of Zelensky.
The vice president was encouraged not to attend for any other reason, do you?
I personally do not, but again, I defer to Ms. Williams.
And Ms. Williams' testimony was that she heard from the chief of staff's assistant that the vice president was not able to go. The reason for that was related to any of these investigations hasn't been fully established.
See, he's saying, oh, this is just hearsay.
From the materials you provided for your deposition, there was a discussion whether President Orban may have influenced President Trump's decision on that May 13th day. And do you remember when the meeting was with President Orban?
I do.
When was that?
That was in May, that's correct.
But do you remember what time of day it was on the 13th?
To be honest, usually these meetings are around lunchtime, sometime in that time frame, in the kind of early to mid part of the day.
Right.
But I can't speak for sure, and I just want to be very clear that I cannot speak about head of state engagements.
Okay. The Jennifer Williams testified that she learned about 11 or 11:15, and the meeting with President Orban was not scheduled until later in the afternoon. According to your schedule, it was right around 1:45. Is that consistent with your recollection?
What about the lunchtime time?
A reporter who was also a CNN analyst, Karun Demirjian, is reporting. Fiona Hill testified that Donald Trump thought that Cash Patel was in charge of Ukraine. This was her earlier testimony. But actually, it was Alexander Vindman who was in charge of Ukraine. But Trump thought that Cash Patel was, because Cash Patel was apparently delivering all the Ukraine information straight to Trump. Now, what's interesting is that Cash Patel used to be a Nunes staffer. He used to work for Devin Nunes. It's getting really, really weird. We're listening to the testimony of Fiona Hill and former NSC Senior Director for Europe and Russia, and David Holmes, who worked out of the U.S. Embassy in Kiev. Right now, they're being interrogated by the lawyer, the counsel for the Republicans, Mr. Castor.
Ukraine remains, for now, the main transit point for Russian oil and gas and pipelines to Europe, and this has been manipulated repeatedly, especially since 2006, by the Russian government. And in fact, I mean, many of you here will remember in the Reagan era. There was a huge dispute between the United States and Europe about the about whether it made sense for Europe to build pipelines from the then Soviet Union to bring gas to European markets.
Mr. Holmes, what was your view of the delegation? Do you think it was the right sized group, right level of prestige to signal to the incoming Zelensky administration that the U.S. stands behind them?
I think it was fine in that regard.
Okay.
Since we're on the topic of Ukraine energy, I think it's a good way for us to segue into Burisma, which I assume both of you are familiar with. You've heard about it for many, many years. You're on the ground there now, Mr. Holmes. I know you weren't there at the time, but in September 2015, then Ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt, Obama appointed career ambassador. I'm sure you know him.
I do.
Credible?
Yes.
Successful ambassador, I'm sure. He called for an investigation into Zelensky, the owner of Burisma, President Burisma. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Okay. Did you know about Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Kent's concerns about the potential conflict of interest with Hunter Biden sitting on the board of Burisma?
I would defer to George Kent, who was involved at the time and is an expert on those issues.
As you know, that the financial records show that this Ukrainian natural gas company, Burisma, routed more than $3 million to the American accounts of Hunter Biden.
I've heard that.
Were you familiar with that, Dr. Hill?
Only from newspaper reports.
Okay. Did you know that Burisma's American, and this is back to you, sure. Mr. Holmes. Did you know that Burisma's American legal representatives met with Ukrainian officials just days after the vice president forced the firing of the country's chief prosecutor?
No.
Did you know that Burisma's American lawyers tried to secure a meeting with the new state prosecutor the same day the predecessor, Viktor Shokin's firing was announced?
No.
Did you know that Joe Biden called Ukrainian President Poroshenko at least three times in February 2016, shortly after the president and owner of Burisma's home was raided on February 2nd by the state prosecutor's office?
No.
Did you know that Devin Archer and Hunter Biden reached out to the Deputy Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, shortly after the raid on Burisma?
No.
Dr. Hill, did you know about, I don't want to go through and ask all those questions over again.
I also did not know.
You did not know about any of those?
I did not know, no.
Okay. So you obviously know that the president had concerns about Burisma, had concerns about 2016 election meddling by the Ukrainians. When you were in there as the head of the Ukraine desk, did you ever raise any of these? Did you ever brief the president or raise it up to Ambassador Bolton about any concerns through 2017 and 18 that concerned 2016 election meddling or Burisma concerns?
The whole briefing process didn't really work in the way that you're suggesting there. So if the president had asked about any of this information, it would have been provided for him. Just to be very clear, Ukraine was not a top foreign policy priority in this period, in the same way that many other issues that we could talk about, from Syria to Turkey and others, are. So there weren't that frequent briefings on Ukraine. The briefings would take place when there was a scheduled meeting with a Ukrainian head of state. Mm-hmm. And as we know, there haven't been too many of those.
So but as far as you know, you did no briefings, no papers, answered no questions as it relates to the 2016 election or Burisma during your time there?
No, I did not know.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Castro.
And Dr. Hill, you told us during your deposition that that there are perceived conflict of interest troubles when the child of a government official is involved with something that government official has an official policy role in, correct?
I think any family member of any member of the U.S. government, Congress, or the Senate is open to all kinds of questions about optics and of perhaps undue outside influence if they take part in any kind of activity that could be misconstrued as being related to their parent or other family member's work. So as a matter of course, yes, I do think that's the case.
Getting back to Ambassador Sondland, you testified that every now and then he made a habit of name-dropping his interactions with the president?
That's correct, yes.
And I believe you also told us that there were instances where you would run into him on the campus and he would say, I'm here to see the president, or I've been in to see the president, and you had an occasion to circle back and found out that wasn't the case?
That's correct.
And I just want to give you an opportunity. He testified about some sort of coffee he had with you on your last day, and I think...
We're back with the Republican counsel, Mr. Castor, who is questioning Dr. Hill. Devin Nunes a minute ago had gone through this whole list of, do you know this person? Do you know that person? Do you know this conspiracy theory? Did you know that Joe Biden called the prosecutor? Yeah, blah, 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 blah. Well, they're trying to lay out their narrative for Fox News. Anyhow, here's the Fiona Hill talking to the lawyer.
Each other, or rather, he found out I was going to be there and then asked me to meet him for coffee in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, in 2018 in August. So this is a full year before I left. That was a very nice coffee, so perhaps he, you know, conflated those two meetings together. The meeting that he was referring to, he had come in to meet with our director for the European Union. This was in my last week in the office. And as I was in the office at the same time for a brief period before going into another meeting, and it was my last week in the office, we agreed to sit down with the director of the European Union, with actually Colonel Vindman, and the assistant that Ambassador Sondland had brought with him from the State Department. So there were actually four of us in that meeting, and unfortunately it wasn't over coffee.
And, you know, he went on to indicate that you were upset and you were upset with
actually,
Ambassador...
Actually, there were five of us really in the meeting. Obviously, I can't do math, sorry.
Fair enough. He indicated you were upset and you were upset with Ambassador Bolton and upset with the way things are going, and I believe your counsel said that was an outright fabrication.
Well, I think you might recall in my deposition on October 14th that I said that very unfortunately I had a bit of a blow-up with Ambassador Sondland, and I had a couple of testy encounters with him.
I think he's still trying to reduce the credibility of Sondland's testimony.
We put you in charge of Ukraine, and you know, I'll admit I was a bit rude, and that's when he told me the president, which shut me up. And this other meeting, it was about 15, 20 minutes, exactly as he depicted it was. I was actually, to be honest, angry with him. And, you know, I hate to say it, but often when women show anger, it's not fully appreciated. It's often, you know, pushed onto emotional issues, perhaps, or deflected onto other people. And what I was angry about was that he wasn't coordinating with us. Now, I actually realized, having listened to his deposition, that he was absolutely right, that he wasn't coordinating with us because we weren't doing the same thing that he was doing. So I was upset with him that he wasn't fully telling us about all of the meetings that he was having. And he said to me, but I'm briefing the president. I'm briefing Chief of Staff Mulvaney. I'm briefing Secretary Pompeo, and I've talked to Ambassador Bolton. Who else do I have to deal with? And the point is, we have a robust interagency process that deals with Ukraine. It includes Mr. Holmes. It includes Ambassador Taylor as the chargé in Ukraine. It includes a whole load of other people. But it struck me when yesterday, when you put up on the screen Ambassador Sondland's emails and who was on these emails, and he said, these are the people who need to know, that he was absolutely right, because he was being involved in a domestic political errand. And we were being involved in national security foreign policy, and those two things had just diverged. So he was correct, and I had not put my finger on that at the moment, but I was irritated with him and angry with him that he wasn't fully coordinating.
Amazing.
And
instead
I did
of
say to him,
hurting Sondland's testimony,
I think
she's
this
helping
is all
his
going
testimony.
To blow up, and here we are. And after I left to my next meeting, our director for the European Union talked to him much further for a full half hour or more later, trying to ask him about how we could coordinate better, or how others could coordinate better after I had left the office. And his feeling was that the National Security Council was always trying to block him. What we were trying to do was block us from straying into domestic or personal politics. And that was precisely what I was trying to do. But Ambassador Sondland is not wrong that he had been given a different remit than we had been. And it was at that moment that I started to realize how those things had diverged. And I realized, in fact, that I wasn't really being fair to Ambassador Sondland, because he was carrying out what he thought he had been instructed to carry out. And we were doing something that we thought was just as, or perhaps even more important, but it wasn't in the same channel.
Right, Sondland was there to smear Joe Biden, and she was there to try to look out for the integrity of the United States and Ukraine. Here's Devin Nunes.
The president of the United States, Commander-in-Chief, was concerned about the 2016 elections and Burisma. He had his personal attorney working these issues because he was under investigation by Robert Mueller, special counsel, partly beginning with an investigation that started with the Steele dossier that we've already established that the Democrats had paid for.
Actually, it started with George Papadopoulos. Nunes is lying. And it was fed to the FBI, and the Steele dossier was given to
the
FBI by John McCain at the request of Lindsey Graham.
Ukraine doesn't, sounds like you had just earlier testified that you weren't aware of that. But if that was the concern of the president to try to get to the bottom of it, and it's the concern of Ambassador Sondland, who was trying to set up meetings on behalf of, to ensure that meetings occurred and phone calls occurred to strengthen the relationship. I understand the people at the NSC, people at the State Department had issues with that, but at the end of the day, isn't it the Commander-in-Chief that makes those decisions?
My point, Mr. Nunes, is that we at the National Security Council either by the President directly or through Ambassador Bolton, that we were to be focused on these issues as a matter of U.S. foreign policy toward Ukraine. So when you're talking about Ukraine in 2016, I never personally heard the President say anything specific about 2016 and Ukraine. I've seen him saying plenty of things publicly, but I was not given a directive. In fact, I was given a directive on July 10th by Ambassador Bolton very clearly to stay out of domestic politics.
Just for sake of the timeline, they hadn't even engaged with Rudy Giuliani yet. I don't believe that happened until a little bit later. So you believe by July 19th they were already engaged in those types of activities?
We had already had a discussion with Kurt Volker, which was in the deep
positions
of his assistant, Chris Anderson, that indicated that he had met with Rudy Giuliani at this point. And Ambassador Sondland made comments about meeting with Giuliani. And as we know, in the May 23rd meeting, they had been instructed to meet with Giuliani.
Right.
They give us every impression that they were meeting with Rudy Giuliani at this point. And Rudy Giuliani was also saying on the television, and indeed has said subsequently, that he was closely coordinating with the State Department.
Okay,
so it was my belief that they were meeting with him.
Okay. And there's some, I mean, there's
take
some
that.
Ambiguity in the direction to work with Rudy Giuliani.
Oh, no, that's ambiguous.
Ambassador Volker said the president dismissed Ukraine and said, oh, if you want to work on it, just go talk to Rudy. And Ambassador Sondland took that a little bit differently. And I believe that Ambassador Volker.
Oh, so the new line of attack here, they're trying to throw Sondland under the bus. And he's saying, Trump was just saying, just talk to Rudy.
Subsequently, from Ambassador Volker's deposition. So I just want to tell you, in that particular time frame, I was not aware of that. And in fact, Gordon Sondland did refer to Rudy Giuliani. And again, Ambassador Bolton had warned Ambassador Volker not to meet with Rudy Giuliani in a meeting.
Mr. Morrison told us both in his
This is all going on in early July, before Trump's call
with
Zelensky.
I did not relate any concerns in general terms about Colonel Vindman's judgment, so I was somewhat surprised when I heard Mr. Morrison make that assertion and when I read his deposition. There was a very specific point that was made, and again, these are personnel issues, and I'm sure that nobody here would like to have their private personnel issues put before a committee, but you've asked me about this. So I had a couple of very short transition meetings with Mr. Morrison. And again, Mr. Morrison did not work in our directorate. He was taking over the position, which he held for 3 months. I had worked on the
Morrison
as the
director,
the senior
Devin director
Nunes
tried for
Europe
to,
and
to trash talk
time for more than 2 years at this point. And I'd been working for a year with Colonel Vindman, with Mr. Vindman.
Mr. Vindman.
And in the course of one of the meetings, sometime in the June timeframe, I sat down with Mr. Morrison and with a deputy referred to him in his deposition, John Erith, who was also working, and we went through our organizational chart. We went through who was staying, who was rotating out and leaving in the summer, and we talked about everybody's strengths and weaknesses. And I always asked my staff to do upward feedback as well, to talk about what I wasn't doing right either. I'd like to learn too. Yes. And I said that I was concerned about the way things were trending in Ukraine policy. So Colonel Vindman is a highly distinguished, decorated military officer. He came over to us from the chairman's office and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And we were evaluating and looking at him in the context of what his future positions would be in the context of the US Army. And I was concerned that if, for example, Colonel Vindman might decide to leave the military, that perhaps he wasn't as well suited for something that would be much more political. I did not feel that he had the political antenna to deal with something that was straying into domestic politics. Not everyone is suited for that. That does not mean in any way that I was questioning his overall judgment, nor was I questioning in any way his substantive expertise. He is excellent on issues related to Ukraine, Belarus and Moldova, on Russian defense issues. He had been in charge of the Russia campaign, thinking through at the chairman's
office. She's just destroying the Republicans
right
now.
This was a very specific issue, because by June, we saw that things were diverging and you needed a completely different sensitivity. Some people in my office have worked at the highest levels of advisory positions, and Mr. Morrison had come from Capitol Hill. He knew politics inside out, and we said that Colonel Vindman did not, and we were concerned about how he would manage what was becoming a highly charged and potentially partisan issue, which had not been before.
And Colonel Vindman related to us during his deposition that he subsequently was sort of cut out of a lot of the decision-making and involvements with the embassy in Ukraine. Was that something you recommended?
Not with the embassy in Ukraine. I mean, we did pull him back from the meeting in May in the Oval Office. Mm-hmm. And subsequently, we were very concerned about these political aspects to this, and we did not feel...
See, he keeps trying to get her to say, basically, you know, he tried earlier to get her to say Soderlund was, you know, full of BS, and now he's trying to get her to say that Vindman is, because these are the two witnesses who both basically laid out this conspiracy between Trump and Giuliani and apparently Volker and Soderlund to get the president of Ukraine to trash talk Joe Biden just to help Donald Trump in 2020.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archive.
And she is having no part of it, and she is saying, no, Vindman was a great guy, and Morrison took my comments out of context.
I believe it was Senator Johnson who had said that the president was concerned about burden sharing, perhaps others as well. And so trying to interpret why this might have happened, we were looking into the facts of what the Europeans have provided and what we have provided. Mm-hmm. It's very illuminating what we learned. United States has provided combined civilian and military assistance to Ukraine since 2014 of about $3 billion plus $1 billion loan guarantees. That's not, those get paid back largely. So just over $3 billion. The Europeans, at the level of the European Union plus the member states combined since 2014, my understanding, have provided a combined $12 billion to Ukraine.
And you were able to communicate that information back at the end of August?
I believe so. Yeah, this was done in collaboration with other missions to the EU, mm-hmm. to NATO, and others. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And do you think that was the information the White House was looking for?
We don't know. If the concern was that we weren't, that others weren't spending as much as we were to support Ukraine, then that information showed a different story.
Okay. And the aid was subsequently lifted? The pause in the aid was lifted shortly thereafter?
It was in early September, in mid-September.
Yield back.
That concludes the 45-minute rounds. We'll now go to member questioning. I'll recognize myself for 5 minutes. First, as a threshold matter, I want to say to the witnesses to be a bit cautious when members represent. Are you aware of this fact? Are you aware of that fact? Do you know that so-and-so testified to this or testified to that? If you have personal knowledge of it, that's fine. And I'm not saying this is deliberate. Sometimes members get it wrong. So let me just clear the record on one of the things that was suggested to you, that the vice president canceled his trip because of a conflict with the trip to Canada. That was not Ms. Williams' testimony. Her testimony was, I asked my colleague why we should stop trip planning and why the vice president would not be attending. And I was informed that the president had decided the vice president would not attend the inauguration. So just offer that caution. Dr. Hill, I want to ask you, you may be aware of some of the attacks on Colonel Vindman, suggesting that he has a dual loyalty, that he's not really loyal to America, he's loyal to Ukraine. I wanted to ask you, as a fellow immigrant, what you think of those kind of accusations when they're leveled against Colonel Vindman or other Americans.
I think it's very unfortunate. I mean, this is a country of immigrants, with the exception, perhaps of very few people still here. Everyone immigrated to the United States at some point in their family history. And this is what, for me, really does make America great. I mean, I'm sure that every single person here, some people perhaps came reluctantly, others came by choice, as I did. But this is, for me, this is the essence of America. It's why I wanted to be here and why I wanted to stay here. And I think it's unfair to castigate anyone. Everyone has some kind of appellate to them. I'm an Anglo-American, perhaps, then, or I'm a British-American, I'm a naturalized citizen. I do not believe that my loyalty is to the United Kingdom. My loyalty is here to the United States. This is my country and the country that I serve. And I know for a fact that every single one of my colleagues, and there were many naturalized citizens in my office and across the National Security Council, felt exactly the same way. I think it's deeply unfair.
Thank you. You mentioned something in your testimony, I might not have this exactly right, that I think Ambassador Sondland at one point told you his role was to make deals. Is that right?
That's correct.
I want to ask
told other people that as well, to be clear.
I want to ask you about one of those deals, the one that Ambassador Bolton described as a drug deal. I had the suggestion, or the indication rather, when Mr. Goldman was asking questions about the July 10th meeting, and the fact there were two meetings, one Ambassador Bolton's presence and then another in the wardroom, that there was more you had to say about that. Do you want to walk us through that in a little more detail?
Well, there are...
Ms. Stefanik.
Before I turn to our witnesses, I just wanted to say to my Democratic colleagues, not a single Republican member of this committee has said that Russia did not meddle in the 2016 elections. As the ranking member stated, we published a report focused on Russian active measures in 2016 with policy recommendations as to how we strengthen our cyber resiliency and election security to counter Russia. I myself have worked with members of this very committee on this issue, but also on the House Armed Services Committee. So to have our Democratic colleagues say these untruthful statements just reeks of political desperation in their continued obsession to manipulate mainstream media coverage. But the good news is the American people understand that this has been a partisan process from the start. The Democratic coordination with the whistleblower, the incessant and astounding leaks, the unprecedented closed-door process, closed to the majority of members, close to the press, close to the people, starting this inquiry without taking a vote, and then when finally forced to take a vote, the vote was with bipartisan
opposition. Elise Stefanik here, by the way, has Tedra Cobb challenging her, the Democrat Tedra Cobb, in the election coming up in 12 months. Tedra Cobb, TEDRACOBB.com, if you want to know about Stefanik's opponent.
You testified that you handed over your duties on the NSC to Tim Morrison on July 15th and that you physically left the White House on July 19th, correct?
That is correct, yes.
So that means that by the time there was the July 25th call with President Trump and President Zelensky, you were no longer on the NSC, correct?
Actually, I was still technically on the payroll of the NSC until the end of August, August 30th of 2019, but I was not physically in the building and I'd handed over my duties to Mr. Morrison.
And you were not on the call?
I was not on the call. That is absolutely correct.
And it's also correct that you did not participate in the preparation of talking points or the specific coordination of setting up the call?
Not for that call, but let me just say for the record that there had been a long anticipation that eventually there would be a call. So there was a call package that was prepared in advance. I just cannot say how much of that call package that had perhaps been prepared since, for example, the inauguration of President Zelensky was then used as the basic material for that call. So I did take part in the preparation of that standard call package, but I did not take part in any preparation for the specific call on July 25th.
And the first time you actually read the transcript of the call was when it was released to the public.
That's correct.
Mr. Holmes, I wanted to turn to you. Good to see you again. Thank you for mentioning the bipartisan delegation that I led on behalf of the House Armed Services Committee with my friend, Representative Anthony Brown from Maryland. We did have an exceptionally informative visit where we highlighted the bipartisan congressional support for Ukraine, in particular the importance of countering Russian aggression. And we discussed in the briefings at the embassy the importance of defensive lethal aid in the form of javelins, Islands, which, as you both, I think you stated today, is, quote, an important strategic deterrent to Russia. And I just want to highlight on the record, I know this has been asked, the Javelins were provided by the Trump administration and not the Obama administration, correct?
That's oh, yes. Correct. Let's trash Obama.
I think we discussed the importance of all our security.
This is really amazing. I think we're all getting a sense of, you know, what Trump did. Thanks so much for being with us. And get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.